From KUOW 94.9 Seattle and KUOW.org. What do honeybees looking for a new nest and commodity traders at the Chicago Mercantile have in common? Both species use similar behaviors, gathering data, independently reacting, voting, forms of aggregation. We see it in other species, flocks of starlings, schools of fish. Julia Parrish is a professor in the biology department. She is director of the program on the environment and associate director of the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. One area of study for Dr. Parrish is animal aggregation, co-editor of and contributor to the book Animal Groups in Three Dimensions. And you just like to look at, for example, as we just did, starlings flying over the sky, in the sky, over Rome.
Absolutely, Steve.
Because it's just cool.
It is cool.
And then you decided from cool to understanding.
Yeah, but I think cool comes first.
So let me just start with, help me understand what we're looking at when we're looking at starlings moving as if they're one being, even though it's thousands of in the flock.
Well, Parrish. I think there's certainly places to start with in the human environment, in human communities. Everything from traffic patterns on the LA freeway to class changes on a university campus to certainly anything that happens at a football stadium, say, when UW, if it ever does, made a touchdown.
Hey. And, hey now.
And so in those kinds of circumstances, what happens? It's not that you actually check with your neighbors and compare notes and say, okay, you jump up first and I'll jump up a second later. You just all do it in a coordinated fashion. So I think that there are plenty of examples where humans are able to do this unanticipated, very coordinated kind of thing. So how do you actually do that? You don't actually make the mental calculations, that is, do the math in your head, knowing that you're doing the math. What you do is anticipate movement, anticipate what's going to happen. So rather than just looking at your neighbor in the seat next to you, if you're going to be part of the wave in a stadium, you actually watch the wave approach. And what's happening is your brain is estimating when it's going to get to you and when you should jump up. And also there's a little bit of social pressure in doing this. For instance, if you jumped up at the wrong time, a little too early or a little too late, you'd be embarrassed because everybody else around you would look at you and think, Anna, who is that boob jumping at the wrong time? So that social pressure combined with your ability to watch that wave and anticipate when it's getting to you lets you jump up at the right time. And we think that many organisms, from insects to birds to fish, are doing the same kind of thing, to anticipate an action by watching distant neighbors in the group.
When you're studying aggregation, which critters have you studied? What have you looked at?
Mostly what I've looked at is fish. And for me, that gets back to cool. Fish are wonderful, wonderful organisms. They're completely three-dimensional. So unlike birds, great in the flock, but they land back on two-dimensional surface, the ground, for instance. Fish are always in 3D, so they're always doing it. And there are some fish that are out in the open ocean environment. So they're in an essentially totally endless, infinite three-dimensional environment, and they don't have any other cues. So there's no bottom. There's no structure. The structure just comes from the group itself. And so that's really fun to think about, that the evolution and the social evolution of those groups happened because they're reacting only to themselves.
Right, so where is it that evolution got us? How far did evolution get us? And then where did evolution no longer, come into play?
Well, evolution really tells us a lot about how individuals might get ahead in the world. So one way of thinking about evolution is that on average, those individuals that are better able to survive, so can last longer, can live longer, and better able to reproduce, that is, can leave more offspring and make sure that those offspring can reproduce themselves, so leave a long lineage, those guys are going to get ahead in the world. And the wimpy ones, the ones that get run over by a bus, the ones that make it to the grocery store after it's closed, those guys are not going to last very long. You know, the geeky guys that always get sand kicked in their faces and never get the girl, those guys aren't going to last very long either. And so that that basic theory has told us a lot about what abilities individuals should have to survive, live long, and reproduce successfully. But that theory is somewhat limited when we look at these fantastic grouping behaviors where all of the individuals in the group appear to be cooperating. And it's hard to reconcile that level of cooperation and sort of balletic movement with this theory that tells us that individuals should be a little selfish, right? Because when it comes right down to it, if you and I are dive buddies and the shark comes along, really, I want the shark to get you, not me. I don't want to go into some neat balletic maneuver with you. I just want to be saved. And so how do we reconcile this theory that suggests to us that selfishness is good with cooperation?
All right. So how do you reconcile it? Why are animals flocking or schooling or swarming?
Well, you know, all scientists do this. They say a combination of it depends and I need more data. But essentially what we are looking at is that there are some benefits to being in the group, both just by being a member of the group, you dilute the possibility, for instance, that a predator will get you. But if the group can act as one integrated unit and, say, avoid predators more often or sense where food is more often than an individual could, then it's good to be a member of a group and an active member. And that, once you're a member in the group, it's kind of hard to get out. And that means that you should cooperate and work together. And that, we think, is the link between evolutionary theory and theories of self-organization, which suggests that once you get individuals together, they can do cool things that a single organism could never do. And thus, you can't predict what a group will do or look like or how it will respond just by looking at the responses of a single individual.
Biology professor Julia Parrish studies aggregation in animals. She's written about it and continues to study it. Can you tell me how, Dr. Parrish, how these how starlings or schools of fish, how they're actually navigating? Are they deciding by distance, by proximity? I know when we look at ants, for example, ants are moving by proximity and attraction or opposition.
Right, right. So one big difference between things like ants and things like starlings or a school of herring is that ants use chemistry. So they're certainly using other sensory systems. Just think about your five basic senses and how you use them to navigate your way around. You use a lot of vision, but you probably also use hearing, and you probably also use smell. If you're an ant, you've translated sense of smell into this exquisite, exquisitely sensitive way of distinguishing what's going on. And so you leave scent cues for the next guy in line. And so when we look at the evolution of ant trails, a swarm of army ants coming in and taking over a new patch of forest, a lot of the development, the architecture of those trails follows from, quite literally, who left more chemical signals and thus reinforced a trail that went in one direction versus another. So what we see is that large-scale grouping structure came from chemistry. But when you go to flocks of birds or schools of fish, that doesn't work very well. And so you need another mechanism. So we think that one of the major mechanisms that both birds and fish use is vision, just like humans. And so we have come up with ways of making a simple model, both a conceptual model and a mathematical model of what happens. And we do that by saying that very, very close to each other, so the next guy next to you, your nearest neighbor, you don't want that neighbor to come within a minimum distance. And that's because if they do, they're likely to crash into you, and that could have negative consequences, especially if you're a bird. So near field repulsion, but farther away, you want to be attracted. That is, you want to go towards individuals so you don't end up all by yourself and get nabbed by a predator. Far field attraction. And then in between that near zone of repulsion and the far zone of attraction is this zone where we think that individuals either speed match, velocity match, kind of the way you do when you're on a freeway.
Mm-hmm.
You just unconsciously match your speed to the guys on either side of you.
Or when you're in a gym on a machine.
There you go. And there's that social thing coming back a little bit. And so those three things, repulsion, alignment, and attraction, can be put together mathematically result in the same kinds of patterns that we actually see the real organisms making. And you can make those mathematical models very complex or very relatively simple. But the neat thing about it is you can think of it like a video game where you can dial up repulsion and attraction and alignment to various levels relative to each other and then see what your computer organisms actually do.
Do you do that?
I do a little bit of that. There are certainly some people that have done a lot more than I have. But the nice thing about that is if you're actually trying to work with the real organisms and follow them in real time, say all fish within a school, turns out that that's a tremendously difficult thing to do. And so we can default back to creating these computer agents, again, a little like a video game, where we can make hundreds or thousands of them and see what they do. We can play what-if games that are somewhere in the intersection between biology and engineering.
By the way, you mentioned herrings schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So predators use that very behavior in order to benefit their own feeding, right? Because they ball up a school of herring, and then they can get it more easily.
Absolutely. And if you extend that thought, in fact, what predators are the most successful on schooling fish? It's not big tuna. It's not porpoises. It's humans, right? The reason that we can take so much fish out of the sea is because we're really, really good at getting fish to ball up and then take the whole ball.
All right, so just as a takeaway, again, when I stare at the starlings flying in the sky, what am I thinking? What am I seeing there?
At the end of the day, it's this really beautiful aesthetic experience, looking at swarming and flocking and schooling. It's really one of the coolest things out there in biology.
Julia Parrish, professor in the biology department, director of the program on the environment, associate director of the School of Aquatics and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington.